The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
A couple of things just very specifically before we start, very, very quickly. That nice quotation that Gary Bass articulated right at the outset of his remarks, I saw a couple of people writing them down. Just want to let you know that full quotation is on the CGS website. You'll find it right at the end. We have a little feature called Quote of the Month. And this month there were so many nice quotes, we have actually four of them for the first time, one of which is the one that Gary articulated. Second point, and I say not just because Danielle Brand is no longer in the room, but she slightly misspoke when she talked about the recommendations that are selected on the green sheets, the survey sheets. She said that they were randomly selected. No, they were not randomly selected. They were selected as representative of what the organizations recommended, in their own words. They were just randomly listed in no particular order there. So the fact that something is number one and not number 24 or vice versa has no significance to one another. The randomness is to the sequence in which they are there. Now, speaking of sequence, I'm not entirely sure the sequence in which this panel will proceed, but I know Patrice has been talking to her colleagues, and what I'm going to start doing is introducing everyone with Patrice. Again, you have the bios in your handouts, and they will be posted online as well, just as we have done with previous CGS conferences. Patrice is someone who has worked for a number of different FOIA or openness-related agencies, certainly the American Library Association and the National Archives and Records Administration. She, like I, have been on both sides of the fence, so to speak, and she now is the director of OpenTheGovernment.org, which is a consortium of very interested, very experienced advocacy organizations who work in the transparency area. Next to her is David Sohn. No, I did it by process of elimination, David. Figured I had no problem. David Sohn is with a very important public interest group called the Center for Democracy and Technology. They cover a wide range of public information, public evaluation, watchdog type activities, the use of technology, harnessing it and developing it, and putting it to its best use as time goes by and technology advances. David is a senior policy counsel there. And next to him is Mike German, who also has been on both sides of the fence, so to speak, in that Mike was not only a government employee, he was an FBI special agent, and not only that, Mike has experience doing things that few people get to do. He went undercover, not once but twice, and he infiltrated openness and government organizations. No. This is the Obama administration. I got to remember. Turn my head around. Okay. He infiltrated, what would we say, survivalist groups? Is that a fair characterization? Or
Extremists,
potential domestic terrorists. Organizations long before Homeland Security was a blip on anyone's radar screen. And he has become, in effect, a whistleblower from the FBI, so he has that aspect to his background. And now he works as National Security Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union, otherwise known as the ACLU. And skipping over Tom Devine just for the moment, because I know Tom is here and about, is Sharon Bradford Franklin from an organization called the Constitution Project. Now, that's an organization that has existed for a while, but it might not be as familiar to openness and government people as other organizations, but they have really emerged on the scene big time very recently in this respect, in that they were responsible, like Gary did in the 21st Century Right to Know Project, for gathering together a lot of groups and compiling recommendations in a range of areas on open government, government accountability, good government type issues. And most specifically, you have in your handbook Chapter 11 of their very large recommendation set, which covers this area in particular. And what I'm going to do is ask one of the ladies on this side to run and hunt down Tom Devine like the dog that he is, because I know he's And speaking of which, now, some people don't care whether they make an entrance or not. Tom doesn't particularly care, one way or the other. But Tom is one of the grand old men of the government watchdog. Is that okay to say, Tom?
Your grand old man.
One of the grand old men of the government watchdog area.
That part is fine.
Okay. The part I may say next, though, you never know, right? Of course. Going way back many years with a lot of experience, and a big believer that you need information to be a watchdog and to hold the government properly accountable to the public in our democratic system. And sometimes that information comes from leaks, and this is Washington, so leaks are sometimes the currency of the day. Sometimes they come from whistleblowers who aren't leaking in the traditional or the conventional sense, but they're disclosing information very often, if not always, about government waste, fraud, abuse, impropriety, and that's a very important information flow as well. So please join me in welcoming our august panel here. We appreciate having them here very much. And we'll be applauding them all the more when they finish, which we're going to try to do in about an hour, I think, if we can. And Patrice, will you start it off?
I will begin.
Thank you very much.
That's on. Okay. Thank you. Welcome. And thank you for joining us. I had remarks that I had prepared for numerous transition papers and all that, and normally I would just pull those out, but President Obama sort of pulled the rug out from all of us. last week, we're very happy that he did. But I'm going to sort of riff on some of the proposals that a number of us have made and talk about the real day-to-day implementation of those, because I think the memos are wonderful, and we applaud the administration and the president for doing those, but the actually getting the agencies to do it and actually getting them implemented is a whole other kettle of fish. And I'm not raining on anybody's parade, but I think we want to talk about what needs to be in the new open government directive and what teeth need to be put in it by the administration and by Congress and by the public to make sure that this directive, whatever it does say, actually gets implemented and actually gets followed through in the agencies. I want to just say about my organization for just a minute. OpenTheGovernment.org is a coalition of openness advocates, openness and accountability, and about half of our 75 members are state-based groups. And I think one of the things that hasn't really been fully addressed here today is the need to engage the states and state-based groups in these efforts, that we here in Washington can talk all we want about what needs to happen and we can have impact, but we really need to engage the public in this endeavor to make sure that the oversight continues. So the public has come to expect instant and copious information on demand, and the federal government has to meet that challenge and make sure government information is not only instant, but as the previous panel said, accurate, authentic, and usable. This is not a drastic new step. We have a framework for openness in statutes and in regulation. Achieving more openness and transparency is a goal that transcends party lines and will allow the president to demonstrate the commitment to change that the electorate has indicated it wants and that he has indicated he wants. The new president has set the tone. He's made a commitment to make transparency a keystone of his appointments, and he's tasked high-level officials in the administration with responsibility for the implementation of the openness mandate. I recommend to you in your handout, your booklet, tab 3, the partners at OpenTheGovernment.org, and we have about 75 organizations that are part of our coalition, played key roles in the creation of those recommendations. Some have already been met. A fair number of them were met with the directives and the executive orders that were issued last week. But we are not done. There remains a lot to be done to make this new administration open, fully open, and really accountable to the public. One of the first steps that nobody else has talked about today that the president should do, or that should be part of the open government directive, is to direct agency heads to review information that was removed after the events of September 11th. Those of us who were around and engaged at that point know that massive, just massive amounts of information was pulled off of government websites at that point. Some of it's gone back up, some of it hasn't. The government had, under the Bush administration, refused to even tell us what the criteria were that they used for deciding to take it down, and what the criteria they were using in making their decisions about what to put back up or what to continue to put up. And we have heard from agency people over the last 8 years that information that they would have normally put up, they hesitated. And they hesitated because there was a tone, if not an actual directive, and you know, the Card Memorandum and the Ashcroft Memo set a very strong tone, even not for FOIA, in saying, when in doubt, leave it out. When in doubt, keep it down. Don't make it available to the public. You don't want, you know, GAO, one of your reports was found supposedly in the cave in Tora Bora. That frightened the hell out of the executive branch of the government. They didn't want to be the one whose agency or whose information was found in Al-Qaeda's hands. The alternative of that is, of course, that hiding information did not make us safe and secure. Making information available makes us safe and makes us more secure. So I think that is one of the first steps that we will ask for, is identify what was taken down, look at it and see what can go back up. Tell the agencies, as the president has, that when in doubt, put it up. Unless there's a foreseeable harm, put it up. The second thing that we think that the president should do, and again, the president should make clear in the open government directive, and this cuts across a number of areas, that the benefit of public disclosure should be heavily weighted in considerations of disclosure and dissemination. And disclosure and dissemination are two different things. Disclosure is essentially FOIA, and dissemination is the affirmative putting things up on the website. And we used to have arguments with OMB about the difference between access and dissemination, I think, but hopefully that won't happen again. If the security costs of disseminating information do not heavily outweigh the societal benefits of information dissemination, then it should be made available to the public. And for any of you that are interested, the Federal Geographic Data Committee, a number of years ago, did a wonderful decision tree about how to weigh those questions, whether the information was already public in other forums, what the risks were, all sorts of things, and it was heavily weighted towards disclosure whenever possible. Another area in which the benefit of public disclosure and the role of the public in helping to protect our homeland security, our communities and our families and our homes, has to do with what we have always called sensitive but unclassified information, or what the past administration called controlled unclassified information. And I know that Mike and possibly Sharon are going to talk some about this, but again, about the problems with the current framework and what should happen with it. The administration last May put out a directive that sets up a new framework on controlled unclassified information. There's many, many problems with it. Primary of which, from our perspective, or from my perspective, is that there's no weighing in it of any public benefit of disclosure of information. There's no sense that the public is one of those entities with whom information needs to be shared in order to protect security. And all of this, of course, all of us, as the previous panel said, do believe there's some information that at least for a certain amount of time does need to be protected. does need to be safeguarded. But the problem with this current framework is there's no system to it. It's not like classified information. There's no ability, and there's no balancing test involved. Another initiative that was alluded to in the previous panel has to do with electronic records. And one of the things that I have asked in a number of documents I put out are, what are the building blocks of transparency? And a lot of them are really mundane. They're the FOIA, they're the Presidential Records Act, they're the Federal Records Act. And but these are the cornerstones of an open and accountable government. If records that belong to the public are to be open and accessible, they must be preserved appropriately and managed. The president needs to require agency heads to make management of government records, regardless of form, format, or mode of creation, the fundamental step. The president, and this president does seem to understand and to be clearly communicating to his staff, that all documents, including electronic communications, that are created or handled as part of the work of government are federal records. I was really heartened to hear when they announced that in the press conference that President Obama was going to be able to keep what somebody called his Barackberry, even though it's not going to be a Blackberry, that Robert Gibbs said very clearly, all of those communications on that BlackBerry, on that device, will be presidential records. They know that up front, and they've clearly communicated to their staff, even when their email went down for the entire day the other day, that if they went to other accounts, those were also records, and that they had to be preserved. This is a really critical step. We have a serious problem, as Meredith alluded to in the previous panel, with our, not only our historical record, but our accountability record disappearing. We and GAO has done a study on the almost non-existent in many agencies, records management. We don't know what's being kept and what's not being kept. We don't know how it's being kept. Sometimes it's being printed out and filed. Sometimes it's being printed out and left on somebody's desk. Sometimes it's not being printed out at all. And this is the same problem with email. And I think one of the things that, from my perspective and a number of us in this community, one of the things that we think really needs to be done is that NARA needs to direct the agencies to handle electronic mail and electronic records, but particularly electronic communications, the same way as any other communications within an agency would be handled, so that the communications of the secretary of an agency and departmental heads and bureau heads and all that are scheduled the same way as a letter from that person would be scheduled. We cannot have them all government email treated in the same way. Again, our accountability record, our historical record is potentially in a shambles, but we really don't know the extent of the problem. We would like the president to communicate to his staff, all civil servants and all contractors that conducting government business on non-government account or computer does not miraculously turn the documents into non-records. Again, this president has indicated a tendency this way, but these are the things that have to be told very specifically to the agencies and to contractors. It's not enough to say we're going to be open and transparent. You have to give very specific directions to agencies who have had 8 years of essentially ignoring the law with impunity. And I would also recommend to you tab 11 in your booklet. This is a set of recommendations that OpenTheGovernment.org and National Security Archives and current government records managers and past employees of the federal of the National Archives got together to draft some ideas about how to move agencies toward the very difficult and expensive need of electronic records management, including email management. It is an incredibly expensive problem. It's a huge problem, but it's something that is going to have to be taken on, and it's going to take the White House and Congress doing it together to make it happen, and we're going to have to hold each of their feet to the fire. Gary, on the last panel, mentioned use of technology. We're all very excited about Web 2.0. But I think there are some cautionary tales that are coming out. One of them is the tales about the White House staff getting to their offices and the dire state of their computers. I think that's reflected in how long it took them to get up those executive orders.
Patrice, is there any truth to the rumor that this time around for this transition, it was the dollar signs that were removed?
Well, you know, some of us, Dan, are suspicious that the report on the emails, the White House people said, well, we've got two servers up and working. They've been restored. But two of our email servers are inexplicably down and won't come back up. And I have to admit that it crossed my mind that there was some sabotage done before the past administration left. But that's just purely my paranoia.
Well, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there's not record disruption.
That's right. But the state of government technology generally, from what we hear, is pretty parlous. And part of the problem that this administration is going to have is, even though the past administration spent, what was it, something like $4 billion on technology a year, that has not gone to building up government's own capacity. A lot of this has been contracted out, which is a real problem. It addresses the problem that was raised about the difficulty of getting web pages up. This is going to take an enormous amount of energy and possibly a fair amount of money that, you know, we don't have because of the bailout and other problems. But we do want, you know, government 2.0. We'd like to get government 1.0 initially, though, and get government information up. And the other thing I think that the chief technology officer and people are going to have to start thinking through is when they do get 100,000 people commenting on the development of a policy, those are records. What are they going to do with them? How are they going to manage them? You know, how are they going to data mine it or apply artificial intelligence to it? Because we don't have the staff in government agencies to read through 100,000 comments, or even if it's 10,000. And then how does that apply to e-rulemaking? There are real difficult problems that are going to have to be dealt with, and while we all feel joyous, we feel giddy. I've had, you know, government people tell me that, you know, they're walking around with grins on their faces. Everybody's really happy. This is such an incredible change in tone. But there's much, much, much to be done. And it's going to take all of us and all of the people out in the country, all of the grassroots organization, to make sure that it happens. And to make sure not only with the White House, but with greater congressional transparency and making sure that Congress passes the kind of legislation that is really needed to enact these things. And I'll stop there and allow my...
Thank you, Patrice. Are we going in sequence down the line?
Okay.
I think so. David, one thing I'd ask you, because we have had one request from the audience, for our panelists, please try to remember to pull the mics toward you. Because if anyone in the audience has any difficulty hearing, we have to extrapolate from that and worry about what it might be on the live webcast as well.
Sure.
Do any of you on the live webcast have any difficulty hearing us? Just wave your hand. Okay. They'd like the mics a little bit closer, I think, please.
Sure. Well, just, I guess, to start by picking up on the theme of the new tone, I would start by saying this is a great start. There was discussion on the last panel, I think, of the different orders that came out, and certainly the content of those, creating a presumption in favor of disclosure, trying to work towards more affirmative disclosure, encouraging agencies to use more Web 2.0 new technology to increase citizen participation. That's all very positive. And then on top of that, just the mere fact that this happened the very first day of the administration, I mean, think about all the things that are going on, all the different substantive issues they have to tackle. It shows a strong recognition that this administration views openness and transparency as a meta issue that needs to pervade all their other decision making, and that they wanted to get that started on day one. And I think that just in it and of itself is a really big thing. A couple other things I'd mention that happened on day one, in addition to the couple orders that came out, for those that were watching the White House's website, there were actually some improvements just with the way the website got put up initially. My organization, CDT, did a study back in 2007 and found that on a lot of government websites, they're using robot TXT files. Basically, they're preventing public search engines from crawling a lot of the data on government websites, meaning if people are using Google or other common search engines, an awful lot of the content on government websites just wouldn't easily come up in those searches. And in fact, one of the worst sites in that regard was the White House's own website. Well, sure enough, when the new website got put up, it basically takes the exact opposite approach, and virtually all the content on that website is now searchable. So that's another example of a really positive thing on day one. One other information policy issue that maybe isn't as specifically a transparency issue, but one that my organization's been following because we are interested in privacy issues as well, relates to cookies and tracking technology. The government policy on the use of cookies and other tracking technology on government websites goes back to about 2000 and is really very restrictive, right? It was born in a presumption that there were some real privacy risks to that technology, which is true. Of course, being able to identify a repeat visitor to a site also can help yield some functionality gains and make sites more usable and user-friendly. And one thing that my organization had called for was to try to update the policy regarding cookies and other tracking technology to try to provide some way to have more consumer choice about persistent identifiers. So sometimes they're useful. Maybe in some cases the users would want that. At the same time, certainly users who are concerned about it should have a way to opt out of it. And sure enough, one of the things that came with the new launch of the White House website was a privacy policy that included some provisions to provide user choice with respect to cookies. It's still in flux. There's been some back and forth on it. There were some hiccups, and I think that's an area for ongoing work. But the fact that they're tackling that issue and trying to get the policy on that right is, I think, a very positive sign going forward. All of that said, though, I certainly agree there's a lot of difficult implementation questions. It's not going to be easy. From CDT's perspective, the big goal going forward should be affirmative disclosure. We'd really love to get to a place where any data that's created that is FOIA-able is disclosed affirmatively, is posted up online without having to wait for a FOIA request. It's an ambitious goal. It's a long way from where we are, but it's definitely the direction we think things should be moving.
David, just for clarity, when you use the term FOIA-able, to some people that means an agency record subject to the making of a FOIA request for it, but I suspect you mean disclosable under the FOIA standards.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Just to draw that distinction there, you're talking about automatic disclosure of everything that's not exempt under the FOIA.
That's what we would like to see the agency set as their goal. I think getting there will require a lot better data management on the part of the agencies. They're going to need better systems to track data flows and to really systematize things so that as new documents and new data are created, there's a way to track where that's going and to have a regular process for ensuring that it does get posted, because if you don't have it systematized, stuff is surely going to fall through the cracks. I think that's going to mean training of personnel, because, again, it's not just going to work to have one person in each agency who's supposed to be getting all this stuff up online. All the various employees are going to need to be creating documents with the knowledge that it's going up online and knowing that they're going to need to get it to the right people and that they're going to need to think about issues like, for example, if there is personal data in the documents that might need to be redacted or some kind of preparation that would need to be done first to make it postable, that all needs to get done. As I said, CDT works a lot in the area of privacy, and one of our core themes in privacy is often that it is a heck of a lot easier to deal with privacy issues through the creation of a technology or product right from the beginning, to basically have privacy by design, rather than going ahead and creating a product or technology or service and then at the end trying to retrofit privacy onto it. I think the same thing applies to transparency. It's going to be a lot easier if that is in the mind of the people who are working on particular documents and data as it moves through the process, not just a consideration that gets tacked on at the end. And then the final thing I'll say, again, sticking to privacy, is that one area that CDT thinks could use some real reform is the Privacy Act of 1974, which is what governs the privacy of personal records held by the government. But, you know, it was written in 1974 really for a world where the government's records on people were held in paper file cabinets, alphabetized by name or maybe numerically by Social Security number or something like that. But that was the rather narrow kind of data it had in mind. Today, obviously, the whole system for both storing and accessing and using data is very, very different. And in a lot of ways, the Act is just woefully outdated, and I won't get into all the details now, but just 3 years even after the Act was passed, there was a commission that looked at it and even at that time recognized there were some shortcomings that needed reform, and now decades later, we've still had no reform of that law, and given all the changes in technology, that's another important information policy step that needs to be taken. Thanks.
I'm Mike Turman with the ACLU. The ACLU has a transition document online that has an entire section on open government, and that can be found at www.aclu.org/transitions.
And it's also in their handbooks as well.
Actually, only part of it is. So
I just put the good part in there.
Oh, there you go. And not the part I'm talking about.
You're talking about the bad part, though, right?
And many of those recommendations mirror things in these other transition documents from the other groups and also things that were discussed earlier in the panel and today. But I'll just run through them very quickly. One is on the repeal of the Ashcroft Doctrine, the FOIA Ombudsman, scientific freedom, signing statements, presidential documents, federal websites, the issue that Meredith has discussed. DOJ politicization. Oh, I'm sorry. DOJ politicization. And finally, on overclassification, which is what I'm going to focus my comments on today. And, you know, the reason I want to talk about overclassification is because of the way we address transparency in all other areas of our government. And I think it comes right out of what President Obama said in his press conference, where he said, the way to make government responsible is to hold it accountable. And the way to make government accountable is to make it transparent so that the American people can know exactly what decisions are being made, how they're being made, and whether their interests are being well served. And yet, we have this whole category of our government that performs perhaps the most essential function, protecting our nation's security, and has perhaps the strongest tools for invading our privacy and depriving us of our liberty. And that part of our government, almost in a reflexive action, we say, well, of course, that shouldn't be transparent. Well, if the whole reason we have transparency is to make sure that the government acts responsibly, I think it's very dangerous to say we don't need transparency in these agencies that have so much power and are so important to our security. And it's sort of counterintuitive how you would accept that that's okay for security in that important realm. So our recommendations are first to end the practice of declassified documents, revise classification procedures to end overuse, and end the practice of using control markings to improperly restrict public access to unclassified information, what's referred to as CUI. And CUI is a difficult issue that I'll get to in a second. Our second recommendation is to reform the military intelligence classification rules to reduce unnecessary classification or reduce the time period materials may be classified in compliance with the Moynihan Commission report. And this is one I wanted to talk about because I think this is really one of the easiest ways we can address the biggest problem with overclassification, because admittedly these are tough decisions when you have a GAO report that's available online and can be used by our enemies wherever they are in whatever way they choose. That makes it difficult to be the person actually making the decision, does this go out or doesn't it? And in acknowledgement of that difficulty, perhaps the way to really address this problem is to just drastically reduce the amount of time that something can be classified, so that that decision is made easier, because if I have to make this decision today, I can go one way knowing that in 1 year or 2 year or 5 years, somebody else will look at it and make the decision again with a little hindsight behind them, and that would, I think, get a lot of information out. And I think a lot of that comes from my personal experience, as Dan said, working undercover, where, you know, it might seem unusual to have somebody who's life was protected by government secrecy be so against government secrecy now, but it was in the criminal context where I knew that while my operation needed to be secret for a period of time, it was a very short period of time after which it would be disclosed in its entirety, and there would be an opportunity to review every decision I made, every approval that I received, and everything that occurred by a group of citizens who were serving as a jury to determine whether my actions were appropriate. And because I knew that was a very short term before that would be disclosed, my incentive was to do everything right and to follow all the rules and to make sure that the decisions I made were wise so that I could defend them. Where if I thought this information wasn't coming out in 30 years, I probably won't be still working for the government, one, you know, and judging by my lifestyle, probably not even alive.
That's a whole different conference.
My decisions would have been very differently. And, you know, it's just human nature that if somebody's looking over your shoulder, you check your work a lot closer than when they aren't. And, you know, a lot of the problems I think we see in the intelligence community over the years, not just with the past administration, but going back to the creation of intelligence agencies, is that so much of what they do is not well thought out, and had there been a few checks and balances, it could have been prevented. The abuses could have been prevented, or just the bad decisions that are being made. And, you know, I think one of the things that we have to understand is that national security isn't necessarily enhanced by the secrecy. And I think John F. Kennedy said it best, and you have to remember that he said it during the Cold War, where now our big concern is this hypothetical concern that some all-powerful terrorist might somehow get his hands on some nuclear material. When John F. Kennedy said this, there were actual nuclear missiles aimed at us, you know, so that certainly the security environment was just as compelling as it is today. But he said the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free society, in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweigh the danger cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. So I think that recognition that the secrecy does not make us better, does not make us stronger, does not make the country more secure, is very important as we discuss this issue. And in looking at how to do that, you know, there was the one commenter came up and said, you know, about the every agency do a review, and that, of course, is always, as a new administration comes in, kind of the easiest thing. You know, I'll have every agency do a review of what they're doing and report back to me in 120 days, 6 months, a year, and then I'll decide what I want to do. And kind of the reason I wanted the Moynihan Commission report mentioned in our recommendations was twofold. One, to bring up this issue of whether just reducing the time limits might be one way to start very quickly addressing the problem. But two, because there's a great appendix in the Moynihan Commission report that talks about previous reviews of the U.S. secrecy systems. And the first one was the Coolidge Commission in 1956. And it declared that the classification system was sound in concept, but also found that vague classification standards and the failure to punish overclassification had caused overclassification to reach, quote, serious proportions, end quote, and had resulted in diminishing public confidence in the classification system. So here in 1956, we know the system is terribly awry and needed to be fixed, but unfortunately, it was not. In 1957, the Wright Commission stressed that the danger to national security arises out of overclassification. In 1958, the Moss Committee attributed overclassification at the Department of Defense and the lack of punishment for overclassification, where there is punishment for underclassification, as a big part of the problem.
Mike, would it be fair to say, and I'm jumping ahead, I realize, that of all the things we've talked about and that are randomly on the list, the survey they'll be filling out later on, would it be fair to say that overclassification and revision of the current classification executive order would be your number one priority?
You know, going back to what Gary said, it's hard to pick a number one.
You're choosing among your children. I realize that.
You know, certainly I think that the fact that that is that national security issues are driving so much of our foreign and domestic policy today, I think that and the excessive secrecy in that realm of our government, I think, makes that a very compelling issue to put very high on the list.
Okay. That's a very political type response in the good sense of the word. And I'm also guessing, just to put another slight point on it, that you might not have said that with such force and urgency and concern 8 years ago, that it's a function of what has happened in the last 8 years that drives that reaction on your part.
I don't know if I'd agree with that. You know, and I think that's the point I'm making by going through these previous commissions, that this isn't a problem of the last 8 years. And of course, the Moynihan Commission was 1997, which is about the time frame you're saying that I wouldn't have said that, where they're saying this is a problem. I mean, certainly I saw that as a problem within the FBI in my daily work, that sort of problems were never fixed because there was never anybody standing over them saying, number one, this is a problem, and number two, it needs to be fixed.
So it's been a problem, as bad as it might seem now, it's been a problem for a long time, make no mistake about it.
I believe so.
Right.
And the CITES Task Force in 1970, which was a Department of Defense Science Board task force on secrecy that focused on DOD, and because it was the Science Board, tended to focus on science and technology. They said the classification system, again, 1970, required major surgery, and noted negative aspects of classification, such as its cost, uncertainty in the public mind on policy issues, and impediments to the free flow of information. Well, of course, if you read the 9/11 Commission report, the impediments to the free flow of information were what they say contributed to the breakdowns in the intelligence agencies and their ability to prevent that type of attack. So, you know, it's not that we have to set up a new commission. These commissions have been done. There are a lot of good recommendations in what they say. The CITES Commission in particular suggests something very, very interesting, especially because it supports my point. They talk about how there should be time limits on classification, very short time limits. And one of the things they say is that it's very difficult to imagine that a secret can be kept for more than a year. And, you know, here they're talking about technology, that something would be secret for more than a year. But certainly it can't be secret for more than 5 years. So 5 years should be the limit of classification. And after that, you know, if the government can make a compelling case why it needs to remain classified, obviously there would be a cutout to make sure that information that's properly held should continue to be But again, shortening that time frame will make sure that the information gets out. And we'll also send a message to the agencies and the agents within these agencies that what I'm doing today will be revealed in a short term, and that will allow me to make a better decision of whether I should do it or not. So switching gears over to controlled unclassified information, and among the groups that talk about this issue, we always say, you know, you should never talk about controlled unclassified information when we're talking about overclassification, because they're two completely separate problems that are too easily misunderstood to be related. But obviously I find it very difficult not to talk about the two things at the same time. And controlled unclassified information is inherently counterintuitive from its own definition. I mean, we're controlling information that by law can't be controlled. That's the purpose of this designation. And the problem is that it's already being done. When the program manager, the Director of National Intelligence Information Sharing Environment, was assigned to review sensitive but unclassified designations or other designations, he found there were 107 used by 20 different agencies with no legal support that, you know, controls how what these designations mean and how the information can be shared. So obviously there was a problem that already exists that needs to be addressed. When the President's memorandum came out, it had a very interesting line that I think is very good. It said the stated purpose of the executive order is, quote, to standardize practices and thereby improve the sharing of information, not to classify or declassify new additional information. Our concern in talking about these two things together is that people will assume that these CUI labels, controlled unclassified information, should be handled the same as classification labels. So if it says, sensitive, that means the same thing as top secret, because that's what these agencies are used to dealing with. They look at the top of the page and they know whether they can share that information. Where the purpose of these designations, these controlled unclassified designations, is to encourage the distribution of information. So you imagine an agency like the FBI has some information that's proprietary to the agency, and they think the state police should know about this, but it's an FBI document that we don't want spread around willy-nilly. We don't want to give it to the state police because they won't know that we want them to handle it somewhat privately. So if we put this designation on it, that will be a marker to the state police, so we can have confidence that the state police will then treat the document with the proper amount of care. And that seems like a very reasonable thing to do if it's understood in that way, and primarily if it's understood that those designations have zero, nothing to do with Freedom of Information Act. They are not new exemptions to the public's access to the records. And one of the other things the President's memorandum does is give the state and local governments the authority to use these designations, which, you know, is sort of has the risk of taking what is a broken system on the federal level and pushing it down to the state and local level, where agencies who are not used to using any controlled access designations would feel that this is now the ability to control whatever we want to control without limits and deny people their rights under state open government laws. And to a certain extent, we've already seen that sort of reduction of state rights happen in Virginia, where a joint intelligence project called Fusion Centers, the Virginia Fusion Center, which is a state entity, recently, a law passed in Virginia to exempt them from the state open government laws. And when one of the state police officials was testifying, he said, well, the federal government told us that if we want access to federal intelligence, we would have to amend our laws to make sure that people didn't get access to those records. So here you have the federal government encouraging state and local governments to water down their open government laws, which is exactly the opposite direction we want to go. So with that, I'll...
Thank you, Mike.
Today is a very timely and exciting moment to be giving a report to you all on whistleblower rights, because yesterday the House, by a unanimous vote, included an overhaul of the Whistleblower Protection Act for government workers and contractors as part of the stimulus package. And unless Senate negotiators block it over the next 2 weeks, we'll have achieved a real breakthrough in transparency through accountability. The House bill, while it needs a little fine-tuning, basically would establish a global gold standard for freedom of speech by government employees, freedom of speech where it counts. And that's what I view whistleblowing as. Without going into the legal definitions, the folks that we help at the Government Accountability Project are employees who exercise free speech rights to challenge abuses of power that betray the public trust. And if all my friends from the within the Right to Know community who specialize in the Freedom of Information Act are doing just indispensable work to create a record of reality behind the exercises of power, the whistleblowers are the living histories who refuse to be rewritten. And it's kind of like we're both cousins in the transparency family. Just as a little bit about Government Accountability Project, who's saying all these things to you, is since 1977, our mission has been to serve whistleblowers. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and we're the hub of a 50-group coalition called the Make It Safe Coalition that has probably all the other folks who have spoken on Freedom of Information Act rights, the National Whistleblower Center, Public Citizen, taxpayer groups like National Taxpayers Union, Civil Liberties, conservative organizations like the Bill of Rights Foundation. And we've all come together to fight for this issue, which is kind of in its moment of truth right now. Today's program, though, is really focused on the Obama administration. And our recommendations, kind of our menu of requests to the new government, was basically threefold. As a predicate, we're optimistic that the new president does share our values, because before he became a senator, he was a lawyer for whistleblowers. The key case that he argued, he wasn't doing it for profit. It was a pro bono case for him. It led to a landmark Supreme Court precedent on liability of county governments under the False Claims Act, which allows whistleblowers to file suit against fraud in government contracts.
Tom, some people might be interested in that little factoid. Do you know the name of the case, in case anyone would like to Google it and track it down?
Chandler v. Hectoen, H-E-K-T-O-E-N.
Thank you.
Very significant kind of showdown for government accountability. Let's go into the points that we've requested his leadership on. And the first one is basically to catch up with what he did on day one for the Freedom of Information Act. That's a presidential directive that will balance out one that President Bush released on his first day of office in 2001. That was a directive that all federal employees are required to report any fraud, waste, or abuse that they discover on the job. And that's good enough as a good matter of principle. But what he left out was that if they did that, it would be the equivalent of responding to a recruiting pitch by the Khmer Rouge to confess your own misconduct during the killing fields in Cambodia. Everybody who followed his orders soon realized that they had just committed an act of professional suicide. What we need from the new president is something which balances out the responsibility of federal workers to fight government misconduct with their rights. That there'll be a zero tolerance for retaliation of those who honor this duty, and that there'll be accountability for the bureaucratic bullies who try to sustain secrecy through repression. That's our first request to the president. The second one is to prove right away that he means it. A number of whistleblowers, primarily national security whistleblowers, organized a petition for President Obama to issue an executive order setting up a program that is, as I summarized, is to repatriate the exiled whistleblowers who were purged during the last administration for following the president's orders and fighting government misconduct. This would be probably the single best step that the president can take to demonstrate and earn the confidence of cynical people whose professional lives have been ruined, that they can take his rhetoric seriously and that he means it. The third request that we made for President Obama is basically to continue the perspective and intensify through leadership the views that he campaigned on and that he lived as a lawyer before he became an elected leader. And that's to strengthen the rights of employees under our free speech laws so that those laws are credible protection against retaliation. And more specifically, to support the overhaul of the Whistleblower Protection Act so that all employees who are paid by the taxpayers will have best practice free speech rights that can be enforced through full due process. Access to court with jury trials to enforce your rights and normal access to the appeals courts. Right now, we don't have any of those goals in the law which is entitled the Whistleblower Protection Act. I'm not sure how much we have the president to thank for this, but that's what we're on the verge of accomplishing after yesterday's House vote. If the Senate follows suit or just doesn't block the House mandating conference, we will have accomplished that goal. And I'd like to close my presentation by just giving you a menu of the new teeth for freedom of speech that are on the table and very, very close to passage. The first one is to close all the loopholes in the free speech law, which theoretically protects any lawful disclosure of serious government misconduct. But thanks to almost rabidly hostile judicial activism by one court that has a monopoly on appellate review, the definition of any does not include disclosures to your coworkers, to your supervisors, as Mike German learned when he was excluded after finding he was retaliated. He only told his boss about the law being violated. It doesn't include disclosures that involve government policy, even if the policy is illegal or sustains mismanagement or waste. It doesn't involve any disclosures connected with your job duties, which is supposed to be the point of a law protecting government workers' right to serve the public. And this was, under the Whistleblower Protection Act, it was canceled 10 years before the Supreme Court did it for the First Amendment. Or really the one that's most surreal is any doesn't include anything if someone has raised it previously. So if you're not the Christopher Columbus of your scandal, so much for protection against retaliation. Well, the law would close all those loopholes, put the any back in any. It also would restore a sane, fair standard to qualify for protected speech rights. Although the law says that you're qualified if you disclose information that you reasonably believe is evidence of significant government misconduct, the court with a monopoly on appellate review translated that into irrefragable proof of government misconduct. Yeah, I hadn't heard of that word before when they issued the decision, but I knew it was bad because the court overturned a whistleblower's victory when the Secretary of Defense had backed him challenging computer fraud. So we knew it was pretty severe. And when we tracked it down in Webster's Fourth New Collegiate, we learned that this means incontrovertible, incontestable, undeniable, or incapable of being overthrown. In other words, it leaves beyond proof beyond a reasonable doubt in the dust. And if you don't have that, you deserve to get fired when you blow the whistle. That's the state of the law currently. It's a trap. That's why, since Congress in 1994 made this the strongest free speech law in history on paper, the track record at the court with a monopoly of appellate review is 3-207. In fact, during the whole 8 years of the Bush administration, the administrative board that has a monopoly on your day in court only found 2 cases of illegal retaliation. Just twice anybody was harassed for trying to communicate with the public. It's become a trap. The third in the legislation would restore the reasonable belief standard and cancel the court-imposed substitute. Third, it would extend free speech rights with independent due process enforcement to national security employees, such as Mike at the FBI, people at the CIA, or people such as Mr. Russ Tice in the news recently from NSA, who had to wait until he had a new president because he didn't would welcome the news, because he didn't have the right to disclose that there was blanket surveillance against of all Americans in our telephone conversations.
Or someone like Thomas Tam, even. You probably want to include Thomas Tam, who was featured on the cover of Newsweek, who was involved in connection with the terrorist screening program, the TSP program, is in the same category.
The same thing. We could have learned about these things years earlier if those employees hadn't been gagged. The fourth thing that it does is extends free speech rights to government contractors, which is where so much of the taxpayers' funds have been shifted to under the last administration. The fifth thing that it does is codify something called the anti-gag statute. And this ties in with my colleagues' presentations. The anti-gag statute was first passed as an appropriations rider against the initial example of controlled unclassified information. It was called classifiable. It was developed by Mr. Poindexter during the Reagan administration, and it was extending all of the liability for releasing really classified information to anything which, after the fact, without any prior notice or marking, were determined that it could or should have been classified. In other words, pretty much an Official Secrets Act, almost anything. And although the anti-gag statute did neutralize that doctrine, during the Bush administration, as Mike pointed out, we've gotten 107 new points of darkness, sensitive but unclassified information. Another one's called sensitive security information. And let me give you an example of how this works in practice.
Tom, I apologize very much for having to cut you off. There are actually 124 of those that we've had listed on our site. But I have to cut you off after 5 of the 15 items that are on your list, simply because we have this commitment to C-SPAN with respect to the luncheon videotaping, I guess. So please, I apologize very much for having to do that, because there's such a rich wealth of information there. And let me just turn quickly to Sharon, who's in our anchor position. I assure you that no one thinks that they have a sinking feeling because of that. But please, wrap up this panel if you can.
All right. Thank you. Dan tells me I have a little time to talk. He did actually extend the lunch a little bit, so I hope I'm not keeping you too much.
No.
All right.
Please take the time.
I'm Sharon Bradford Franklin with the Constitution Project. We are an independent think tank that promotes constitutional safeguards by bringing people together from across the political spectrum. And under our rule of law program, we focus a lot on issues on preserving checks and balances, and a lot of issues on post-9/11, reconciling our civil liberties with our national security. So we come to this issue of openness issues, area of openness issues, from more of that national security, liberty, national security perspective. As Dan mentioned, last year we worked with a coalition of over 20 different groups to pull together a series of recommendations for the incoming, at that time, transition team on recommendations for the new government. And one whole section of those related to a whole host of issues pertaining to secrecy and ending secrecy and promoting openness and transparency. You have at tab 9 of your materials just one chapter, that's chapter 11, compiling some of those recommendations. But other chapters addressed other issues we've been talking about today, including overclassification that was addressed at some length by my colleague Mike German. Now, I too want to welcome the wonderful announcements by President Obama on his first days in office. The quote I pulled out that I loved was, "Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency," which gets us all very excited. But I also want to just the douse of reality here. The difficulties here are not just in implementation of that. We also have the issues that some of the panelists earlier this morning and here today have referred to with changing the culture. And we had such a culture of secrecy and pseudo-secrecy that we are coming out of that these new pronouncements are welcome change in that direction, but it's going to take a lot of work to actually reverse that direction. My colleagues on this panel have been mainly talking about transparency to the public, which is critical, and I join them and echo them in those recommendations. I want to talk to you very briefly, though, about another type of transparency that is critical to accountability, and that's transparency within the government, transparency to other branches of the government. Now, the culture of secrecy of the outgoing Bush administration was really very much tied to the administration's notions of executive power and the unitary executive. And under this view, only executive branch officials could be entrusted with information pertaining to our national security and sometimes classified information. And in court proceedings and before Congress, executive branch officials would argue that only they had the national security expertise and the discretion permitted such access. Well, there's no real basis in our Constitution or our laws for that notion. And officials went so far as to assert that the executive branch could determine which members of Congress could have access to certain information. But under our constitutional system, congressional committees, when they have jurisdiction, have a right to have access to information, even if it relates to our national security or our foreign affairs material. Other panelists have mentioned that sometimes, yes, we recognize there are genuine national security secrets that should not be disclosed to the public, that there would be harm that would come from that. But that's not the same as saying it's all tied up within the executive branch, and there can be no checks and balances, no accountability to other branches that might be able to see things differently. I just want to provide you three quick examples here of what I'm talking about. Two of those come from our experience with the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program, what the Bush administration called the terrorist surveillance program. The first example comes from back before any of us knew about that program, when the administration was trying to fulfill its obligations to inform Congress. They decided they would do that simply by telling the so-called Gang of Eight of congressional leadership. Well, there's no basis for limiting that briefing to that. By federal statute, Gang of Eight briefings are permitted for covert actions in, quote, extraordinary circumstances affecting vital interests of the United States, but not for other intelligence activities. There's really no statutory or constitutional basis for the executive branch to have insisted on those limits, and they also said no staff could be present. Similarly, after this program was disclosed, the public found out about this program in December of 2005 with the New York Times article, and then various committees of Congress started to investigate what had been going on. Well, in the course of that investigation, it was revealed, and as this was going forward, the administration was trying to legalize the program. And it was revealed that they had gone before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which had jurisdiction of the relevant statute, FISA, and had gotten some orders authorizing surveillance under a new interpretation of FISA. So they said, we fix this now. We can do this. Well, so the House Judiciary Committee, which has jurisdiction here and was conducting an investigation, said, we want to see those orders. The Justice Department responded that the president had decided that only members of the House and Senate intelligence committees would get that information. Only they would be, quote, read into the program. And that they'd fully briefed the intelligence committees and the Justice Department, the House Judiciary ranking member and chair could only see some documents if they went over to the intelligence committee's offices, and they couldn't be read into the program. Well, it's Congress who has the power and authority to determine which of its committees have oversight over any particular subject matter, and the President cannot pick and choose between the committees with overlapping jurisdiction. The final very brief example I want to give you of this is with all these Office of Legal Counsel opinions that we've all heard so much about and that were secret. Well, the outgoing administration took the position that the President could, in fact, decide not to follow an existing statute or revoke previous Office of Legal Counsel opinions and not even tell anybody, not even tell Congress that this was going on. They would be going about their business, not following the law, and no one even knew. Now, everyone recognizes that there is certain right to attorney-client privilege between the Office of Legal Counsel and the President, so certain matters are going to be kept secret there. But the fact that they weren't even disclosing that they had decided to not follow a federal statute or had decided that it didn't apply to the President, that's something that they kind of should be telling Congress. So last year we did see legislation introduced. It hasn't gone through. We hope it will. For the OLC Reporting Act, which would require at least the very fact that OLC has taken such a position to be disclosed to Congress while still leaving some protection for an attorney-client privilege. So basically, in some areas here, we need more proactive reform by the administration. The administration can change a lot of these positions on its own. In some cases, we're going to need Congress to actually pass legislation to ensure that we really do restore Congress's own role. It can assert its authority and maintain those checks and balances. But at bottom, we must reject the notion that only members of the executive branch can be trusted with national security information. Now, I just mentioned, I myself served for many years as a line attorney in the Justice Department, so I don't mean any disrespect here, but the notion that a low-level line attorney in the Justice Department should have more access to national security information than members of Congress and their security-cleared staff is really ludicrous. Similarly, we must reject the notion that independent federal judges cannot be entrusted with such information. That issue arises in the related context, beyond the scope of today's panel, of the state secrets privilege, but I just want to flag that for you because it comes up there as well. Thus, even where there is information that cannot be disclosed to members of the public, we must ensure that the executive branch shares information with its co-equal branches of government. This type of transparency is also critical to restoring our system of checks and balances, the rule of law, and accountability to the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon, for so succinctly and efficiently capping off the panel. And I apologize, we don't have time for questions. However, I believe most, if not all, of the panel members will be at the luncheon where there can be networking and further discussion of these issues. So I'm going to ask everyone to stand up right now. Well, first, let's have a round of applause for the panel. And as you leave your seats and move briskly to the luncheon, which is on the other side of the building in the direction which I'm pointing, let me just mention a couple of things. First, I'm going to reiterate that we really do want everyone to fill out these evaluations, or rather I should say questionnaires, even if you can't stay with us all the way to the 4 o'clock program. And Tom is nodding his head. I mean that for the speakers as well. This is a participatory democracy. Let your voice be heard. Everyone here should be filling one out. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make sure the photographer does as well. Secondly, for those of you looking for webcast, please, everyone, get up and move briskly, even while I'm talking, because we want to get caught up on our calendar, our schedule. For those of you out in webcast land, I want to let you know that we will be webcasting the luncheon. However, that will not be live. So those of you watching us live, you will have a dark period, so to speak, even on this day of sunshine for a little bit. But the full website, pardon me, the full webcast will be put up. Plus, in addition to that, C-SPAN is covering that luncheon, so it'll be available in that medium as well. And again, thank you for your kind attention this morning. And we'll move quickly over to the luncheon now.